I know it's early days yet, but this may very well be Donald Trump's economy already. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. Friday, the 18th of November. Good as always to have you with us, everybody. Here are a couple of phrases with which to begin the end of this week. Janet Yellen, inflation, Donald Trump, $1 trillion, and economic nationalism. Quite the setup for 5 minutes of live radio, huh? Who better to do that with than Felix Salmon? He's from Fusion, and Lynette Lopez from Business Insider. They are in our studios in New York, not far, as it happens, from Trump Tower. Hey, everybody.
Hey, Kai.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Felix, let me start with you. Just because it was the first time we had heard from her since the election, Janet Yellen yesterday on the Hill said, economy's fine, but we're banking on some inflation because y'all, congresspeople, are going to spend a bunch of money, right? About what's to be expected.
Yeah, people are really expecting that Donald Trump is going to do this fiscal stimulus infrastructure spending thing, and that's going to be so stimulative that we're going to get inflation. I'll believe it when I see it, but I'll be quite happy because inflation is this thing that hasn't really reared its head in the Western world for the past decade or so. And so it'd be awesome if we got some.
Lynette, yeah, any doubt this is coming? Yeah, go ahead.
I have no doubt that the infrastructure spending is coming, but I have doubts as to how productive it will be and how much of a how much it'll move the needle in terms of economic growth
or inflation.
Real quickly, why do you doubt?
Because I think we're going to get to that in your second quote that you said, but when you spend money on infrastructure, for it to be really productive or for it to be really good for the economy, it has to be productive. It has to give us things that we needed. And from the sounds of it, we're not really going to get that from a Trump administration.
So speaking of what we're going to get from a Trump administration, there was an article. There was an article in the Hollywood Reporter today by Michael Wolff about Stephen Bannon, Donald Trump's right-hand strategist and the guy who got him elected, basically. And Bannon offers this quote. It's long. I'm going to read it to you, and then I want to discuss it. Quote, I'm the guy pushing a trillion-dollar infrastructure plan with negative interest rates throughout the world. It's the greatest opportunity to rebuild everything. Shipyards, ironworks, get them all jacked up. We are just going to throw it up against the wall and see if it sticks. Lynette, discuss. There's a whole lot in there.
This is exactly what I was talking about. If you're going to start throwing things against a wall and see what sticks, you're going to have a disaster of an economic plan because you really need to target things that are going to help the economy become more efficient and get paid for by the American people. They need to be worth their while. And when you don't have that, you have what we have in China, ghost cities, bridges to nowhere, roads that lead
or to Japan.
Nothing. Or Japan.
And we've seen this. And like the first half of that quote makes, could have been Larry Summers. We have negative interest rates around the world.
We need to be spending money.
The second half of that quote is basically, make America 19th century Liverpool again.
No, it's a disaster.
And you're shipyards? What?
No, shipping has been on the decline since trade has been in decline for the last 5 years. I mean, people are taking apart ships because no one's using them. So building shipyards would actually be ridiculous because there's no demand for them.
All right,
To be more precise here.
Let me give you the second half of the quote then, because this is a much more philosophical part of what he said. Quote, it will be as exciting as the 1930s, greater than the Reagan Revolution, conservatives plus populists in an economic nationalist movement. Felix, what do you suppose that means?
When he's talking about the 1930s as some era of greatness, that sends shivers down my spine. Steve Bannon, of course, comes from the alt-right.
Mm-hmm.
Breitbart News side of things,
which is
Michael Wolff is painting him as like the spider at the center of the web, this little Karl Rove figure in the center of the White House. And honestly, I know that this is Marketplace and we're meant to be talking about the economy and that kind
no,
of
but that's
thing
what this
but
is,
my real fears here are much bigger than a bad economy. It could be so much worse than that.
Yeah, and remember that this infrastructure spending is supposed to be coupled with massive tax cuts for the wealthy. So we're just going to blow a humongous hole in our balance sheet here in the United States. And another reason why this isn't like the 1930s is we are not in the throes of a deep depression. So everything that the government government does has to be more precise than what FDR, who, by the way, was a Democrat, relax, Bannon, it has to be more precise than what we were doing then, because for things to matter, to have an impact, they really have to be the things that we need.
Okay, so with this piece and with the stimulus program that everybody, including all three of us, believe is coming, and that Janet Yellen believes it coming, and the market believes is coming, is this already Felix Donald Trump's economy?
Well, I don't necessarily believe that it's coming, because it's going to have to get past a Republican Congress. We don't know how...
Tea partiers who don't like to spend money, traditionally.
How good they're going to be.
All right, okay.
And as I say, like, you know, Obama came into power promising lots of stimulus, mm-hmm. and it all had to get dialed back when he ran into the realities of Washington. It is possible, believe it or not, that Donald Trump is going to find himself in the executive and not really able to pass laws.
Lynette, last word goes to you. What do you think, stimulus or no?
I mean, I think it'll actually happen. I just hope to God that they do it right, but it sounds like they're going to do it wrong because none of these people know what they're talking about.
Lynette Lopez at Business Insider. Felix Salmon is at Fusion. They're both in our studios in New York. Thanks, you two. Have a good weekend.
Thanks, Guy.
Bye.
All right, see you soon. On Wall Street today, net to the downside. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Word leaked from Trump Tower this morning that Alabama Senator Jefferson Beauregard Sessions has been chosen to be the attorney general in the new Trump administration. Senator Sessions is a Republican who favors not only broad deportation of undocumented immigrants, but also drastic reductions in the number of legal immigrants allowed to come to the United States. He has written that in the second great wave of immigration to this country, beginning back in the 1960s, that has been the main force driving down wages. Marketplace's Amy Scott looks at that argument.
Senator Sessions has argued that the continued flow of legal immigrants hurts American workers. In an op-ed in the Washington Post last year, he cited research by Harvard economist George Borjas, who found that high immigration from 1980 to 2000 reduced the wages of low-skilled U.S. workers by more than 7%. Stephen Camerata is director of research at the Center for Immigration Studies, which favors low immigration.
The people who lose from immigration tend to be the poorest American workers.
But that research has been disputed by several economists. Giovanni Perry is an economics professor at the University of California, Davis. He says it assumes that immigrants and American workers are competing for the same jobs. But in fact, he says many U.S. workers have moved out of the manual construction and agriculture jobs now being filled by immigrants. Perry's research has found an insignificant impact on the wages of low-skilled workers and even a positive impact on high-skilled workers.
Most economists will say that actually the impact of immigration has been one of positive effect, both on wages and on income per capita.
If immigration slows down in the long run, he expects the economy will too. But Alex Narasta with the Cato Institute says there's a short-term concern as well.
In order to plan business expansion, firms and investors need to know how many more people are going to be in the United States due to immigration.
And he says uncertainty over what the Trump administration will do throws a wrench into those plans. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
All right, changing gears here for a sec. Diversity is an often stated goal of some of the flagship companies in Silicon Valley and Seattle and other tech hubs in this country. It is also an often missed target when they actually run their numbers. So it is with Microsoft, which has now made public some additional efforts to recruit underrepresented groups. The size of executive bonuses in that company is going to depend in part on meeting diversity goals and recruiting more women and minorities. From the Marketplace Bureau at Oregon Public Broadcasting, Mitchell Hartman has that one.
According to the colorful graphs on Microsoft's Global Diversity and Inclusion webpage, the company's workforce is 25.8% women, 5.5% Latino, and 3.7% African American. Click to the tech and leadership tabs, the numbers are even worse.
It is real muscle being put behind diversity initiatives.
Rachel Sklar is co-founder of Change the Ratio, which works to boost women's and minority participation in the tech industry.
Diversity for the past few years, and it's been very in vogue to say, no, we're working on it. Really, we care so much. But if it's not a priority, then at every step of the way, there will always be a white dude that you can justify hiring.
Management professor Charles Brown at Rutgers says the key here is to include diversity as an ordinary part of bonus evaluations.
Managers are used to this measurement on productivity in other areas, and you send a particular signal when you make it a measurement they are going to be paid on or have an effect relative to their compensation.
Lemu Coker, an African-American tech manager at Verizon, says to succeed, executives will have to cast their recruitment net farther afield.
If they're looking for students who have that hustle, that have that drive, that might not have done well in high school and gotten into Stanford, they need to widen their gaze about the universities that they're trying to recruit from.
And Coker says that pipeline problem goes beyond the tech firms to the education system that feeds the industry. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Contrary to his earlier protestations that he would never settle just on principle, today President-elect Donald Trump did indeed settle lawsuits against him over his Trump University real estate seminars. $25 million is the amount. Those seminars are, of course, just a tiny fraction of Mr. Trump's business dealings, but they represent much larger questions being raised about how or even whether he's going to be willing to put distance between his corporate interests and his governing. The tradition is for presidents to put their assets into blind trust, but there is nothing traditional about the approaching Trump administration. From New York, Marketplace's Mark Garrison has more.
Here's the idea behind a blind trust. If you don't know what's in your portfolio, it's harder to make a decision that favors it. Samuel Zakharoff is a constitutional law professor at NYU.
A person who faces potential conflicts of interest divorces himself or herself from any active management over financial assets.
Technically, presidents are exempt from federal conflict of interest laws, but recent presidents have worked to alleviate the conflicts. President Obama came into office with a little money that he invested in what the law considers free of conflict, like diversified mutual funds and U.S. treasuries. President George W. Bush was wealthier, but he was already familiar with using a blind trust from his time as Texas governor. Those are relatively easy cases, unlike President-elect Trump, who has never held office.
We've never had somebody come into office from being an active businessman.
And the Trump holdings aren't just stocks that can easily transfer into a blind trust. His wealth is also tied up in hotels, golf courses, and licensing deals spread around the world. The Trump Organization is being vague about what will happen. It says it's trying to figure out how to transfer management to the children in a way that will, quote, comply with all applicable rules and regulations. But turning over management of his assets alone isn't enough for a growing chorus of critics on all sides.
He should give them to a professional, independent trustee to liquidate.
Sell it all and put the proceeds into a blind trust. That's what Norman Eisen, former top ethics lawyer for President Obama, is calling for, along with his counterpart from the George W. Bush administration, Richard Painter.
If the trustee decided simply to roll everything into one big IPO, that there would be a strong appetite on the part of investment banks to underwrite it and of investors to purchase stock.
Yes, Trump going public, or the president-elect could sell his stake in some kind of private equity transaction. None of this would prohibit the Trump kids from having a stake in or running the business, as long as there's a ban on them talking about it with the administration.
It doesn't prevent the president-elect from discussing birthdays or family occasions, obviously, with his children. But in terms of business matters, the people involved in the Trump Organization should not be talking to the United States government without White House counsel screening it first.
This may sound like a long shot, some wild fantasy of good government groups, and it is, but now even the Wall Street Journal's conservative editorial board is backing it. Whether it's this plan or some other arrangement, these business conflicts are real, they're significant, and they're going to continue to be a distraction for the incoming administration until they're resolved. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
Coming up,
They want to see women who are not in this particular brunette badass mold that every female lead in Star Wars tends to be.
What the women who love Star Wars really want. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is off 35 points today, nearly 0.2%, closed at 18,867. The NASDAQ down 12 points, 0.2%, 5321. The S&P 500, 5 points lower, nearly 0.25%, 2181 there. For the 5 days gone by, the Dow up 0.1%, the NASDAQ up 1.6%, the S&P 500 up 0.8%. We mentioned the Microsoft plan to tie bonuses for executives to the company's diversity goals. Microsoft down 0.4% today. Apple up 0.1%. Clothing retailers looking a little dressed down heading into the holiday shopping season. Abercrombie & Fitch reported weak sales and a smaller profit than everybody had been guessing. Gap explained so-so quarterly earnings yesterday, saying fewer people are in its stores. Abercrombie unzipped 13.75%. Gap off 16.6%. Bonds down. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note, 2.34%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal, here with a story about how a dollar is a dollar is a dollar until you don't have enough of them. Two things you need to know. First of all, Alabama is working on a new version of Medicaid, a plan that's had to be delayed a year to find a way to meet a huge budget shortfall. Second, the state does have some cash in its BP settlement fund, money the company agreed to pay after the 2010 Deepwater Horizon oil spill. Oh, and three, nothing in budgeting is ever quite that easy. Gigi Duban reports now from Birmingham.
Are all her immunizations up today? Yeah.
There are kids here with broken arms, birth defects, hearing impairments. As the only hospital in the state dedicated to kids' medical care, Children's of Alabama stays busy.
Look this way. Look against that wall. Good job. 4'1". Cool, girl. You're getting big.
Medicaid is the lifeblood of this place. More than half of Alabama's Medicaid recipients are children. Alabama is one of 19 states that opted not to expand Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act. Instead, it had big plans to overhaul the program. But it ran out of money, and the plans stalled. That worries Mike Warren, the CEO of Children's.
About half of our revenue comes from Medicaid.
Alabama plans to launch these regional care organizations. They're a network of doctors, hospitals, dentists, equipment makers, and they form a managed care system. The idea is to streamline care at a lower cost. But getting that system off the ground is expensive. The state faces millions of dollars in administrative costs alone. Plus, federal money that Alabama counted on is no longer available. Total Medicaid budget shortfall this year? $85 million.
That was addressed using part of the BP settlement monies. This year's Band-Aid short-term approach to funding shortfalls in Alabama.
Alabama Governor Robert Bentley says,
well, then they're exactly right.
He says it is a Band-Aid.
But it's better to have a Band-Aid than to hemorrhage to death right now.
The BP money, part of a $1 billion state settlement, saved Medicaid this year and next. But there's no long-term funding. And a few of these regional care organizations, the doctors and hospitals in this network of Medicaid-managed care, see the writing on the wall and they're dropping out.
This is not surprising.
Sarah Rosenbaum is a health law and policy professor at George Washington University.
The provider community becomes exquisitely sensitive to changes that essentially undercut the very conditions you're trying to create.
She says these hospitals and doctors are worried that once the BP money runs out, they'll be stuck with higher costs in the long term. In addition to the $85 million the state is using now, it'll take another $70 million of the BP money in 2017. Rosenbaum says this is about the time the state might want to consider expanding Medicaid. It means more low-income adults will have insurance, and it also works
to generate tremendous new revenues for healthcare providers that previously either had to give charity care or provided uncompensated care, you know, for people who could not pay the bills.
But Governor Bentley says Medicaid expansion will cost the state, citing the 10% states have to match after 3 years of full federal funding.
We don't have the money to adequately fund the program for the million people that we have right now.
If funding remains shaky and more providers drop out of the state's new managed care system, Alabama might not have a choice. In Birmingham, I'm Gigi Duban for Marketplace.
Now for a change of pace on a Friday afternoon to a galaxy far, far away. There's a new Star Wars movie coming out in a couple of weeks. Rogue One is the title, the second consecutive film in that franchise with a female lead character. Amanda Hess wrote in the New York Times not too long ago about those characters and, more to the point, the female fans of those characters and the movies overall. Amanda, it's good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
Women have been interested in Star Wars, you know, from the get-go. What has changed about sort of the nature of that fan base, that fandom?
Well, you're right. You know, women have been really well represented among fans in Star Wars since the first movies came out. In fact, you know, women were really instrumental in creating early fanzines that were sent through the mail, and they were so overrepresented that one woman who wrote a fanzine penned an essay asking where the men were because they couldn't find enough of them. But, you know, then the internet happened and Star Wars became even more of a corporate property. And this whole sort of mainstream fandom bubbled up around it. And all of these fans were connected. And it really sort of became a much more male-dominated space.
And it's interesting because, you know, one of the things you point out in this article is that there are so few actual female leads and relevant female characters in the Star Wars universe that fans can't watch them have relationships with each other, if that makes sense.
Yeah. So the typical, you know, test that you would use is the Bechdel test, which is it's a woman in a film speaking with another woman about something other than a man.
Right.
And it's a pretty baseline test of whether a movie shows the real lives of women not in relationship to men's lives. And the Star Wars films have suffered on that front. And so what we've seen in the fandom, though, is a lot of women who come together and very much pass the Bechdel test among themselves. There are a bunch of podcasts now where women come together, talk about Star Wars, talk about the women they love in Star Wars, talk about their relationships with other female fans and with their daughters and their mothers. So they've really created for themselves online something that the films have not yet really given them.
Yeah, but here's the thing, and this goes back to your point about Star Wars now being even more corporate than it used to be, right, with Disney owning it. You can count probably on the fingers of one hand the main female characters in all of the Star Wars movies, right? Is Lucasfilms, is Disney listening to this fan base?
It's a great question. I think, you know, I think they are. So I do think that Lucasfilm thought by emphasizing the character of Rey in The Force Awakens that they were really reaching out to young female fans. And many of them have come back and said, great, we love Rey. We want to see other types of women. We want to see non-white women. They want to see women who are not in this particular brunette badass mold every female lead in Star Wars tends to be.
Right. But haven't they already demonstrated their tone deafness? I mean, if you think about The Force Awakens and how huge Rey was in that movie, and then lo and behold, no action figure of her, right?
Yes.
And you're like, come on, man.
Such a disgrace. But with every film, I think we're seeing them course correct a little bit. So in the run-up to Rogue One, you can buy every type of djinn gear that you could possibly imagine. So I think they have at least heard that, which is, you know, it's a low bar, but they've cleared it this time.
Great. Low bar. Lovely. Amanda Hess writes on culture for the New York Times. Amanda, thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
This final note on the way out today, just to close the loop on that Hollywood Reporter article on Steve Bannon, the incoming chief strategist and senior counselor to soon-to-be President Trump. It is, as I said, with Felix and Lynette up top, a really interesting piece. But it ends with this quote from Mr. Bannon. I am, Thomas Cromwell in the court of the Tudors, end of quote. He's referring there to King Henry VIII and his senior counselor, Thomas Cromwell. Fan of history that I am obliged to note that things ended really, really badly for Cromwell. He got beheaded. That's what happened to him, Thomas Cromwell, by Henry VIII. The Dow off 35 points today, 0.2%. The NASDAQ down 12, that is 0.2% there. S&P 500 off 5, nearly 0.25%. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Nancy Fargali. Sitar Nieves is the executive producer. Deborah Clark is the vice president. I'm Kai Rizal. Have a great weekend, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.